Hello and welcome to another edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by the very wise and knowledgeable Sarah Gong. Sarah, how are you?
Good, thanks, sir.
Very good. And the energetic and feisty Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I must say, I'm happy with that description. I always know within the very first word of your introduction whether you're going to me or Sarah first. And usually when it's something very complimentary, it's just, it's not me, but I mean, I'll go with energetic. I mean, that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
I think
I have a good eye, not nice eyes, a nice eye. I'm just I'll close the other one for you. Anyhow, that's a whole different
Our listeners need to know that Herman actually trained to be an opera singer, so he doesn't just have a nice eye; he has a good ear. But that's neither here nor there. So let's get on to our first story of the day.
Neither here nor there.
Oh gosh.
That I still have a job and colleagues who actually speak to me is a miracle.
Come on. Right, let's get on to our first story for today, which is, I'm sure people have heard about this idea before, but they may not have thought about it a lot, or maybe weren't quite sure what it is, but it is creeping closer and closer. What am I talking about? It is, of course, growing meat in a lab. So recently, in Israel, there was an opportunity set up by a company called Supermeat, where they allowed their various people in the public who signed up in advance to come and taste test some meat that they had grown. So in this case, it happened to be chicken. What's special about this chicken, however, was that using a process where they took cells from a fertilized chicken egg, they grew this meat actually in the laboratory to basically create artificial meat, so to speak. The cell cultures are fed a plant-based liquid, including proteins, fats, sugars, minerals, and vitamins. And this causes it to grow very quickly. And so it was given to people. And one of the people who tried it, a guy who described himself as a meat eater from Tel Aviv, said that it was delicious and the flavor was great. If I didn't know, I would have thought it was a regular chicken burger. So there's a lot of questions being raised by this development in technology, because there are some thoughts that perhaps one day it could, in fact, replace farming in general, for the most part. I mean, I'm sure there'll always be people who prefer, shall we say, organic, naturally grown meat. It could also potentially bring down the price of meat by a large amount if a sort of industrial level scale was set up here. And so now the manufacturers of this meat have applied to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to give them a license to increase the production of their product to a commercial scale. There are also other questions being raised, which is to whether the meat is kosher, halal, or vegan. Some people are suggesting that this could potentially be a way for vegetarians or vegans to enjoy meat products in the future. Because, of course, no animal is necessarily no animal is actually killed to produce the meat. Sarah, your thoughts on this topic? Are we all in 20 years, 30 years going to be eating meat from a lab in our McDonald's hamburgers?
We might be. And if we do, then cows and chickens will be roaming around the streets until something eats them. But be that as it may. Look, there's quite a strong sort of vegan, I won't say lobby, but a vegan lobby in Israel. And it's done on a humanitarian, put forward on a humanitarian sort of basis. I don't know enough about the rules with regard to veganism, in the sense that if you're using cells from an animal body through the egg to create the meat, whether that is deemed sufficiently far away enough to be attractive to vegans, or whether it would still contravene the living organism thing. But it certainly it would have to be manufactured to scale, because certainly what is produced at the moment, there is some available, and it looks pretty horrible, and it costs a lot. The impression I get from the rabbinate is that deeming it kosher wouldn't be particularly problematic. They would just have to go to where it's manufactured and do whatever rabbis need to do to deem it kosher. And I assume this is the same would probably apply with halal. So I suppose it's vegetarians and vegans I can't really answer to at the moment. But it's certainly, if it does work, and, you know, I tend to give the Israelis the benefit of the doubt on this because they do achieve some extraordinary things scientifically, but it certainly could do a lot to save farmland, the use of farmland, the methane gases produced by the cows, etc. I'm not in principle opposed to it. I just kind of hope that it look, you know, it's not grey or something. And then again, it may be hit by the idea that we're going through a lockdown where something came out of a lab, and people may feel uncomfortable about the fact that this comes out of a lab. But maybe we'll have got over it by then.
Yeah. So I guess, Herman, same question to you, but also I just want to first start off by saying I think that there's going to be a lot of cultural pushback to this, because people hear the idea of, you know, meat grown in a vat or something, and they imagine something out of like a Soylent Green dystopian future, something like that. And it just, there's something in the way that we think of ourselves and our food and that kind of thing. I think that like on a very basic level makes us kind of feel a little bit uncomfortable about this idea. So do you think that people will ever take to the idea? And if so, would it be a good thing? What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's difficult to say, but I might be terribly primitive in this in this regard. But if I can't see something, if I can't kill something and eat it, then I'm just like, what's the? No, I'm kidding. I must say, there's something very primitive about, you know, just a good old chicken. And I don't know. I might be a traditionalist in this regard, but personally, it doesn't really. I wouldn't, if I had to look at a menu and I could choose an actual chicken or a faux chicken, I would go for the chicken. But the problem is on two fronts. Firstly, when Sarah said there was a strong vegan lobby, I thought, my goodness, I didn't know vegans had enough protein to be strong in any regard. But can the Israelis, and this is a serious question, can the Israelis produce a stable government in a lab? Because I mean, or at least I'm kidding. Okay, enough of the very, you know, satire.
That's impossible.
But
science has its limits.
But especially in the Holy Land. But I do think that there are a few things here in terms of what's the actual, you know, carbon footprint of this thing. You probably have a lab.
Proponents are claiming that it has a much reduced sort of pollution footprint in general.
I'll have to, you know, I'll believe that when I see it or when I look into it, because the same was said about soybeans 10 years ago, and now we know that soybeans is enormously damaging in terms of the levels of complexities it has to go through to actually reach market in a product form. So on the one hand, yeah, it's likely, I mean, technology goes that direction. On the other, I think the jury is probably still out on whether it's actually efficient. But then on a third point, In Africa, I think it's going to take a long time to catch on. I mean, it would be quite sucky if your, you know, chicken doesn't go all the way because of load shedding or something.
It's a horrifying thought. I think the idea, though, is that, you know, possibly in the future, I don't think the technology is there yet, but it would be substantially cheaper. And so, in fact, you might see places like America and Europe with lots of farmland being more resistant to this than perhaps somewhere like Africa, where people are willing to take the reduced price, even if it means eating something strange out of a vat. I mean, some factory farms at this point kind of already blurring that line a little bit between, you know, manufacturing in a lab.
To also be fair to the technological advancement of I can't remember the dwarf, is it dwarf maize or dwarf corn, where genetic manipulation in a lab essentially made it possible to grow shorter corn stalks or maize stalks, that the plants wouldn't collapse and they would need less water because the water didn't have to go all the way up the plant. And that made a massive difference in Africa in, I think, the 70s or 80s with its development. So, I mean, it's very easy for me to say, but there are some genuine technological food breakthroughs that have fed people that otherwise would not have gotten food. So if it can do that, you'll see me being its strongest proponent.
Interesting stuff. I think that the world.
Sorry, you're on mute though.
Sorry, I just wanted to interrupt, but I was on mute. I think you make an important point, and that is that if the processes require much less water, then the prospect of saving water, particularly in water dry countries, other than Israel, which is water dry and has overcome that, I think that's a plus two. That would be a plus two. I go with Herman on the idea of actually seeing a chicken and eating a chicken, but I guess, you know, needs must.
Definitely. I still, in my mind is very interested in the idea in trying a product like this, but my gut is still a little bit hesitant because it looks at this and it goes, are you sure
about it? It's against the laws of God and man.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that we could be in for a profound revolution in the way that we use space and that agriculture works in the next couple of years. Because another innovation I've read about recently is the idea of vertical indoor farming, where you have sort of rows of plants on top of each other. And apparently there's some evidence that might one day be more efficient than having big old fields. So in 50 years from now, when I'm an old man, this may well, the world may look very different. We may have a lot less farm.
One thing also that you know, self-criticism here is someone with very little exposure to agriculture like me, you know, city dweller through and through, might think, farming is now the same as it was in the 1750s. So, you know, farming will stay farming. It won't catch on technologically. But actually, if you go look at the methods, the biochemical science that goes into these things, agriculture really agriculture has really, in many ways, been at the forefront of cutting edge biological science development. So it wouldn't perhaps be that weird, that big of a leap, as you say, from where we are currently with battery farms. You know, it's just, instead of glass jars, you've got cages slightly bigger, the size of a dog. So it might not be that much of a progression or of a leap for laymen like myself. But if you can 3D print biltong, sign me up. Just sign me up.
Indeed. Sarah, any final thoughts?
No, that's it.
All right. So if you are interested in this topic, I suggest go and do some research on it. I think you'll be quite interested to see some of the developments and some of the ideas that are coming out around this. And also maybe leave in the comments below what you think about would you eat meat grown from a lab? I'd be interested to see what people think. Also, please just remember before we move on, I just want to say if you want to support the IRR, our news analysis, all that kind of stuff, please SMS your name to 32823 and we'll call you back to sign you up as a friend of the Institute. All right, let's move on to our next story today, and that is soldiers caught charging money to allow stolen vehicles to cross the Limpopo border. So this is a good news story. Six soldiers who were stationed on the Zimbabwe border at the Bike Bridge border post have been arrested for allegedly colluding with criminals and law enforcement to move cars illegally across the border. Apparently, the soldiers were allowing criminal gangs to smuggle cars across the Limpopo border in exchange for 15,000 rand per car. A team including the Hawks Crime Intelligence National Intervention Unit and the military were set up to catch the six, who were aged between 30 and 51. Now, I just want to, on an aside here, the South African Army is incredibly old in terms of average age. The fact that it's filled with people between 30 and 51 doing border guard post duty. Anyway, the military ranks range between a lance corporal and a private. And apparently they were arrested by the team all over the country. So good news. It's rare that you see people going to jail for sort of corruption stuff like this, but I think it highlights the larger problem. And I'm going to go to you first, Herman. South Africa's borders really aren't borders at all.
Yeah. And one might get lost in the theory of you know, what is a state and what isn't a state. But I think everyone can agree that, you know, a government or a state should be able to do two things. Otherwise, it really doesn't have a very strong claim to being a state. Keep its people safe and keep the integrity of its territory. And the fact that the integrity of our territory is so I mean, compromised isn't an appropriate word. I think the correct phrase might be, you know, our borders are a cluster copulation, in the sense that in many instances there are more gestures than anything else, and that compromises many things. But one of the bugbears I have about this is that it gives politicians with some xenophobic tendencies an easy out to blame people who have come over these borders. And you know, no one stopped them. There was no fence, there was no infrastructure, and Home Affairs is such a disaster that, you know, to actually enter the country legally is difficult. I had a friend in Zambia, a South African citizen, who had difficulty traveling back to South Africa because Home Affairs was just, you know, quite useless. A South African citizen, apparently they need to be in South Africa to apply for a passport or something, but they were in Zambia when the passport expired. I mean, it's a whole thing. But the long and short of it is that if you can't keep your borders intact, you really, really have very, very little claim to actually being a responsible state. And it just opens the door for many, many bad things, xenophobia being one of them. And, of course, the you know, uncontrolled usage of some public infrastructure that does have capacity limits, clinics, hospitals, schools. So I must say, it's quite disgusting that the South African government can't even do that. And whether good that they stopped these people, I mean, well done. But yeah, I'm just petering into frustration, so I'll just keep stuck and let Sarah say something.
You really do see all of South Africa's problems, I think, actually in the borders. Everything from crime to organized crime to illegal immigration, xenophobic violence, of course, is related to this as well, because when people think that the borders are porous, they're more likely to get sort of freaked out by immigration. So I think it all comes together. But one of the other issues I wanted specifically to connect us to, we've been talking a lot recently about firearms. Now, proponents of gun control in South Africa claim that criminals are mostly getting their weapons from basically stealing them or from private owners. I wrote a report recently which kind of goes into why the evidence on that is very weak. But one of the other points against it is not just that you know, private owners are supplying firearms to criminals inadvertently, but that our borders are so porous that if you're going to try and disarm private individuals, what's to stop people from just importing guns over the border? Sarah, am I right to think that? What are your thoughts?
I would imagine that, I don't know, but I would imagine that anything is capable of coming into or out of this country, because what these arrests show is the amount that they charge per car. But this is, you know, this has been going on for years. I mean, the production line up to Mozambique and further north, oh God, it's been going on for years and probably decades. So you also see the thing of sort of, I don't know what the word is for them. I'll call them couriers for the time being, but people who sort of smuggle Zimbabweans over the border. Everyone's got a way to make money, and you know, the only way I don't think you'd ever stop this, but the way you'd really bring a, you'd have to really have good enforcement processes and. We don't have them, and I don't know if we're going to have them. I mean, if you're going to, it doesn't matter who they are, whether it's the police or the army or the Home Affairs, they have to be near incorruptible, then they have to be competent, and they're prepared to go after these things. And I'm, much as I like to see that some people have been arrested for it, because, you know, cars are a valuable thing to have stolen. I mean, it's huge. And of course, it affects your insurance premiums thereafter, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not hopeful that that we're going to see this action having a ripple effect to people, either fear of being caught or actually any sense that it's going to be slowed down or stopped.
And Nick, if I may quickly add something, what I also find a bit distressing about this is just the death of public service. In many cases, I mean, it's a broad generalization, might be quite naive, but the idea of the police and the army, the Air Force, the Navy, there's this idealized vision that young boys grow up with, that there's something to do good. There's this idea of public service, that it's not about the fat paycheck because you're not going to get it. There is something in loving your community and loving your country enough to serve it. And these people clearly have no public service bone in their body. And I think a fish rots from its head. And I do think part of this is the cadre deployment nonsense, where rather than engendering this idea that your country is worth serving, your community, fellow human beings, is actually worth serving, it's just, oh, I can make a quick buck here. I can pinch off at the top. And that's just a collapse of discipline, a collapse of the chain of command, a collapse of the symbolism of what it means to serve your country in uniform, something I've never done, probably never will do. But if that sort of symbolism rots from the top, and the fact that it's reach these sorts of instances just shows that something like public service in South Africa is dead for practical purposes.
Can I say something directly in response to that? Do you know that today is United Nations Public Service Day? Really? And 702 this morning was asking people to phone in, or last night, I can't remember, to phone in and give an example of good public service, good experiences. And in the period I was listening, we only got the post office in Benmore.
Well, at least someone apparently is doing good work at the post office. So I want to throw an idea to both of you, or to either of you, very quickly. So I read an article recently about how Iraq, which is also a country that is... you know, has big problems with corruption, is trying to deal with its borders. And it's got so much corruption on its borders, it's decided that it's actually going to try and automate the process of crossing the borders and paying tariffs, and take people as much out of it as possible. Do either of you think that that might potentially be a solution for South Africa?
Well, unless somebody steals the equipment. But, you know, if you look at airports around the world, the extent to which going through passport control is automated, an automated function. I suppose it's not impossible, but that presupposes that people aren't getting in under the fence.
Right. And also that the system, the contract isn't given to a corrupt cadre who then hooks it up in a certain way to benefit certain parties, which is a situation.
Yeah, that's exactly the point that I would make in response to that. It is all good and well in you know, privatizing, but... you do sit with this hangover of, you know, corruption being baked into the system. So, you know, adding more baking powder might not necessarily, okay, this metaphor is really running away from me, but you get what I'm trying to say.
Right. At least, unlike Iraq, we don't have to deal with Iranian-backed Shiite militias roving around the country. However, we do have taxi gangs, which might be just as dangerous. So, you know, maybe we can learn some things from each other. But apart from that,
one thing.
Yeah.
Very quickly, one of my favorite 2020 COVID moments was when a gang leader in the Cape Flats announced that they were ceasing activities during the pandemic. And I just think more leadership from a Cape gang lord than the state. That's gotta say something.
Yes. All right. Let's move on to our last story for today, and this is one from the United States, and I think it's a pretty good microcosm of all of the chaos that the culture wars are causing in the United States. So the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has written a draft document, which has not been adopted yet, but in theory, it could result in the rebuking of pro-abortion Catholic positions and preventing them from basically being able to take part in the communion in the Eucharist if they support abortion. This prompted a Democratic politician from California, a guy called Representative Jared Huffman, to tweet, "If they're going to politically weaponize religion by rebuking Democrats who support women's reproductive choices, then a rebuke of their tax-exempt status may be in order." So in other words, he's threatening to challenge the church's religious tax-exempt status if they do, in fact, prevent abortion-supporting politicians from giving the Eucharist. So this is, of course, created a big blow-up, a big furor on American social media as to what the role of the government is and how it can respond to religion like this. Herman, you're a man of faith. Tell us what your thoughts on this are.
Well, before I do that, one very brief anecdote. When you said furor, I once taught a debating team and they couldn't pronounce the word correctly. So me with my blonde hair and blue eyes just, you know, slammed the table and shouted furor. And I think that must have looked quite frightening. But I do think two elements actually here. Firstly, I think if your church is, if your religion or your faith is worth enough for you, you should be able, a congregant should be able to contribute enough so that the tax exempt status doesn't matter. I keep taxes as low as possible, but in a weird way, I quite have some sympathy for the secular idea of, you know, why should religious institutions have this special position of being tax exempt? I have a lot of time for that. But what I do think is fascinating about this is that a country like America, enormously religious, predominantly pro-Christian. The idea that there was always going to be a permanent Democrat majority ignores the fact that immigrants from south of America, you know, Mexico and further, are Catholic. And if the Catholic Church is actually starting to discover some Sarah always calls testicular fortitude, it might really lead to a recalibration or a reorganization of party loyalty. So the fact that the church is actually starting to stick to its principles, even though I'm not Catholic myself, I do think is positive and can be a significant threat to the left-right spectrum as expected, as people expected it to develop in America, with more immigration, a less white population, meaning a more ethnically diverse population, meaning a more leftist population. But if the church starts discovering some gumption, those Catholics coming in over the southern border might be natural Republicans.
Sarah, your thoughts?
As I joked earlier, I would put my money behind the Catholic Church on it. It's still a powerful force in America. It's wealthy, and also the decision that's adopted would, as I understand it, and I don't speak from first-hand experience, but would conform with the principles and the teachings of the Catholic Church. So, when the Democratic House Representative says that, you know, the church is weaponizing, he might be weaponizing, but this it would be fairly down the line for the church to take this position, and in a way it'd be kind of interesting, particularly for the Democrats, which would include Joe Biden, is to see to what extent taking a political decision for abortion would be counteracted by a religious decision against it. So I think it's a fairly natural thing, the fact that it may affect the president, neither here nor there.
Of course, that's the part I left out, is that this potentially would leave Joe Biden basically at odds with his own church, because he is, of course, a practicing Catholic. So that's what generated so much controversy on this. An interesting debate. I'm not sure what who's going to come out on top, but I suspect that no one is actually going to bother to put such electorally suicidal legislation forward and hope that it will pass. Only someone who hasn't got a single worry about whether Catholics are going to vote against them might support legislation like this, and that's very unlikely. Anyway.
If the party that does that loses Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, one shot, gone.
Yeah, probably. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. I think this was a bit of a weird episode of the Daily French Show, but we hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe if you did enjoy it. Please like the video. Please leave us a good review on one of the podcast platforms if you listen to us there. Thank you very much, and we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.